My pleasure to have Mr. Casey Nelson. Dr. Casey Nelson is the Associate Medical Director of the Emergency Department's at SIH. First off, Dr. Nelson, morning. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
I'm curious, what's your bed count this morning?
Well, I'm not sure of exactly our bed count this morning, but we have been hovering at or near capacity for the past couple of weeks. I can tell you that much.
Right. The number I have this morning is 60. And, you know, that's up from the previous record of 56.
Yes, correct. I would say that we had 60 patients as far as COVID patients are concerned. We've had 60 COVID patients in our unit as of yesterday. And every day we are at that or approaching that number, which is a record number for us.
I got a personal, kind of just a curious question from my own standpoint. I've talked to a number of people who are experiencing COVID. They're at home in isolation. And you know, they kind of described their symptoms. And I was kind of curious, out of this, when you see so many people, positive cases, at what point should you go to the emergency department? What symptoms are the ones that are a keynote to say you need to go to the emergency department now?
That's a great question, Tom. And I know that there is some confusion within the community about when to come to the ED if you're having COVID-like symptoms or you've tested positive for COVID. The symptoms that we really are looking for are if you're having trouble breathing, of course. If you're having a difficult time breathing, please come to the emergency room. In addition, if you're having chest pain or persistent chest pain, we want to see you in the ED. In addition, we also want to see you if you or your loved one notices that you're having confusion, you're not quite yourself, something seems off, please come to the emergency room. Also, if you're having any bluishness in your face or around your lips, this is often a sign that you're not breathing as well as you should be, another reason to come to the ED. And then finally, I would say that, especially in our elderly patients, we are seeing COVID hit them especially hard. And a lot of times how they will present is with just this terrible weakness, weakness to the point in which they have a difficult time even getting out of bed. They stop eating or drinking. If they do get out of bed, they are obviously a significant fall risk. And these are patients that we want to see in the emergency room. Now, of course, if you have other what you feel to be urgent medical issues associated with COVID, please come and see us.
You know, here's an interesting thing when you look at this. All right, we'll say 60 beds, and not necessarily everybody that is in that bed is from Jackson County necessarily. Of course, we've got Heron in the system as well in Williamson County. But let's take a look at this. You got 60 in beds, but the population of Jackson County as of 2019 is 56,750. And we know that we have a difficulty keeping up with 60, staffing and other issues that come there. But I think when you take a look at 60 and the effect it has on the health system, and then you take a look at the population of the county of 56,750, I think if you start combining these numbers, you get how easy it would become to overwhelm the system.
Absolutely. And that is our biggest concern at this point in time, is overwhelming the system. We do have 60 COVID patients like you referred to before. The part of the issue with staffing and COVID is it is labor intensive, and so we have to make sure that we have adequate staff for these COVID units, which often require more staff than on a regular unit. So we're losing some staff from our regular units sometimes if we have to provide the adequate staff for these COVID patients. So yes, like you said, 60 seems like a small number, but it is a large number in terms of resources. And even since the onset of this, we have taken care of 497 inpatients with COVID since the onset of all of this craziness since the pandemic began. And so, yes, this definitely causes a stress on the system.
Well, I was curious about that. I mean, and it's hard to do because it's done in groups, but how many people do you think it takes to take care of just one patient? If you thought about it in a linear way, one person, how many would it be?
Well, that's a great question because there's so many different levels of care that are necessary. Whenever somebody gets admitted to the hospital, it's not just a nurse and a doctor that's taking care of them. You also will have techs that take care of them. You also have housing staff as far as custodians are concerned. You have registration clerks. You have people that have to make sure that the phones are getting answers, that labs are getting put in, et cetera. So it's multi-level. So to say for one patient, you are requiring multiple staff members to oversee their care.
You know, I'm starting to really come through the funnel on a different level now on how important a fast test is.
Yes.
Because that period of time from you don't know to you do, and what people do during that time, and the longer the period of time is, I'm starting to see this in literally a much different way recently.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up, because I definitely wanted to make sure we address this, because I know that there is some confusion or misunderstanding within the community regarding the tests and the testing times and the testing availability. At this point in time, I do want to make sure that I stress that we do have drive-through testing available at multiple locations, one in Marion and one in Carbondale. If you would like to get tested, you have two options. You can either go online to sih.net/COVID test. That's sih.net/COVID test. And that allows you to actually arrange your own time to go to the drive-through and get tested. You can do that all online. The other option is to call the COVID hotline number and arrange it that way. Now, with that being said, the reason I brought that up is because people are going to these COVID drive-through test sites, and it can take 24 to 48 hours to get those results back. And that can be a very trying 24 to 48 hours. I understand that. And we do have shorter tests available, but the problem with those is we have to restrict those to our inpatients at this point in time. So, for example, if we are admitting a patient that just is coming in because they have a hip fracture, do you want your mother with a hip fracture to be in the same room as somebody who's COVID positive? Of course not. We want to avoid that. So we have to restrict using those tests that have a shorter turnaround time to our inpatients so that we can test them to prevent unnecessary or avoidable exposure to other patients in the hospital. And unfortunately, the number of tests we have with that quick turnaround time is extremely limited. We are doing everything we can to try to get as many tests as we can. But right now, those tests are extremely limited, so they're really restricted to inpatients.
I'm very much a kind of linear thinking when I think about this. The funnel, all right? Let's talk about the funnel. That is where you get the testing. And then you've got the output on the back end, 3 to 5 days. And then you say, okay, you're positive. What are your symptoms? Should you be in the hospital? You should not. And they say, wait a second, hold on. We don't have a bed right now. We're waiting for a positive test, but look at these symptoms. Maybe it's something else. I can see little tiny disconnects that may be very impactful from a positive test symptoms to where do they go when you've got so many beds already full. That I can see a little clogging at that point of the funnel.
Yeah, you're correct. There is. And that is something that we have meetings regarding every day, multiple times a day in our system. At this point in time, you know, this is a new scenario for us, and we're working through it, and we're doing the best that we can to work through it. And unfortunately, there are some clogs in the system at times, but we are aware of them. And we're doing everything we can to make sure that it's as efficient as possible with caring for our patients. But unfortunately, sometimes there are some longer wait times as far as getting admitted to the hospital. But we are aware of it, and we're doing the best that we can.
And I think there's another issue here that's maybe a little harder to appreciate. Cumulatively, your admission has been 434 patients. Now, some of them more than once, with deaths between, well, the youngest at 40 and the oldest at 95. And I think that this cumulative admission number has an impact on staffing and abilities as well, because there's some fatigue, and then the fact that we've seen things change. I mean, I'm kind of wondering now, I mean, when it comes to what is responsible for us seeing a lower death total, a percentages of death? Is it treatment? Is it mutation? I mean, there are still some unknowns, while at the same time, we've been fighting this so long. Fatigue, every once in a while, I guess, we're speaking with Dr. Casey Nelson, you got to stand back and reevaluate what you're doing so you make sure you're doing the right thing, because the target seems to be moving.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there are certainly some unknowns with COVID, though there has been so much more scientific literature published regarding COVID since it first started. And that has really helped us as far as certain treatments that we have available to us. Those treatments are really limited, and they are really focused on the sickest of the sick, if you will. And so I would have to say that, yes, it is definitely an ever-changing scenario. As far as admitting these patients to the hospital, I did want to also correct you. We are now up to 497 admissions
okay.
for COVID.
All right.
And it doesn't seem to be stopping anytime soon. I would say also the point that you mentioned as far as our lower death rate than what we, mortality rate than what we had expected when this first started, has a lot to do with the surge. When this first started, and whenever you look at, say, some of the bigger cities, say New York or even out in Washington, the mortality rate was quite high because the system was overwhelmed. They were not able to care adequately for all the patients that were presenting to them. And so we have been very successful in flattening the curve up until this point. And I think that that has been very helpful. And we're doing the best that we can, obviously, on our end to try to make sure we're taking the best care possible of these patients.
All right. Now, you were talking about research, and I want to ask you about something I've been reading and a little bit more. And I said, I'm not a doctor, but I try to do my best when it comes to comprehending this. And we'll talk about this as viral load. Let's just imagine two individuals who are standing in the parking lot, and one of them has COVID. And we put them in a refrigerator box, you know, a box that a refrigerator gets shipped to the local hardware store. We put them in there, and they sit in there, and they stand and talk to each other for 15 minutes. All right, and then we take the exact same two people in standards, and we put them in a barn, and they talk for 15 minutes. The viral load that the negative person is exposed to, all right, the person in the refrigerator box will, according to research, become a lot sicker than the person who is in the barn. We assume that they both get it at some point, but the one who's in the smaller box gets a bigger load of virus and becomes sicker as a result as opposed to the barn. I'm wondering, you've read this material too?
Yes, I understand what you're saying, yes.
What do you think about it?
Well, I think it makes sense. If you are in a smaller enclosed space with somebody who is coughing or sneezing and spreading virus particles into the air, the smaller the enclosed space is, the more likely you are to contract that virus. Now, with that being said, you do bring me to another point I wanted to make sure that I make. There really is only one approach to this that has been scientifically proven to decrease transmission of the virus. And I know that this is a polarizing issue, but I do want to stress that this is the only piece of evidence that we have that is scientifically proven, and that is wearing a mask. So, for example, with me, I work with COVID patients every day in the emergency room. And then after I leave work, I go to the grocery store. And let's say I'm not wearing a mask. Do you really want me? And mind you, we wear PPE, we take all the precautions, but we are working with COVID patients every day. Do you want me standing next to you or your grandmother not wearing a mask and placing that risk? No, of course not. And that also does bring me to another point, Tom, with when you talk about viral load and viral shedding. We also see that with children, especially, say, adolescents, they can actually be asymptomatic, but they can be shedding as much virus as a 60-year-old who has a terrible cough. And so it is possible for them to transmit that virus unknowingly. And so if, let's say they're not wearing a mask, you're not wearing a mask, they happen to spread the virus to you, you don't know it for days, so you go home, you spread it to your loved ones, they don't know it, they go out and spread it to other people, and that is how the pandemic can get even worse. And that's why I want to stress the one thing that you can do on your end at home, without a doubt, that can help to save lives in our community is wear a mask.